Now, it's The Six with the Jeff Calkins Show.
Fortunately, the Mid-South Food Bank is there to help, and we are doing a food bank drive. It is Food Bank Thursday. You can go to 929ESPN.com to donate, and we urge you to do that, please. And we're going to kick off the food drive with an interview with Food Bank Director Kathy Pope, who joins us now. Kathy, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
So what is the need?
The need is great. I love that we're focusing now on the hunger in our community, but we have hunger 365 days a year. It has been obviously multiplied because of the COVID-19, the layoffs, the business closings, et cetera. So just to give you an idea, in Blue Skies last year, we would distribute 1.4 million pounds every month.
What does Blue Skies mean?
In Blue Skies, no disaster, everything.
Oh, when everything's
normal.
1.4 million pounds a month?
Pounds of food a month, right.
Here in the Mid-South area. Okay,
Mid-South area, and we can serve 31 counties. So in April, after the virus got going and people were layoffs, et cetera, we distributed 4.4 million pounds of food in 1 month.
That's incredible.
And you were talking about the lines of the cars, and I hope that people are seeing that we're really doing a lot of mobile pantries in our community to make sure that we're getting in those neighborhoods that don't have access to nutritious food. But we are doing, I think we did like 163 in April compared to a normal routine of about 40.
163 so food pant where you go into a neighborhood and distribute food.
Exactly. We go into a site. We've already advertised it. It's actually, the schedule is on our website, midsouthfoodbank.org, and you can click mobile pantries. And that is just a way to very easily and quickly get food into neighborhoods where normally you might go to our brick-and-mortar pantry, your neighborhood pantry. You know, it might be your church down the road. But the need is so great, those pantries cannot handle the numbers that we're seeing. We can serve 500, 800 families at a time. So the truck shows up, we get the food to the families, they leave, we leave, and then we're done. And it's just a great way to get food out to those who need it quickly. And we've done a great job of doing that since the pandemic. And I'm so proud that 40% of what we're serving is fresh produce. So we're doing a great job of getting nutritious food out to families.
Do you, in terms of that, like typically before in a non-pandemic time, you largely are working through, the food that's in the Mid-South Food Bank is distributed through various pantries. Is that how it's largely distributed?
That's right. We have 300 pantries, so we serve the 12 West Tennessee counties, but we are also in North Mississippi, the 18 North Mississippi counties, and Crittenden across the river in Arkansas. So our job is to get food in the warehouse from various resources. Department of Ag is a great partner. Manufacturers will donate. We purchase. So we get all that food in the warehouse, and our pantries know what we have in inventory, and they order what they need. So one pantry may serve 50 families a week, one may serve 300 a month, you know, whatever their need is, they can order that food, and then we get it delivered to their pantry. So if you were hungry in Crittenden, Arkansas, you would go to one of our pantries over there, of which we have supplied most of the food that they serve. So that's kind of how we've been working. But because the need is so great right now, we, the food bank, have had to actually conduct a lot of the mobiles ourselves.
And is it simply because people are thrown out of work? Like what is driving this? Obviously the pandemic, but then beyond that, is it because people simply don't have the jobs they once had? Is that basically what the...
Yes, but it's also 40% of us could not make it the next month if we had a $400 unexpected bill. So that's what the research tells us about how folks are living paycheck to paycheck. And we know this. Well, if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you're missing one paycheck and now you miss two and now you miss three, that's difficult to come back from. So that's what we're seeing, is that you know, most of us don't have a lot of money in the bank to hold us over for 2 months.
Right.
And so that's why it's been so important that we, the food bank, have we ordered food before this March 12 is what we call disaster day one, because Shelby County schools closed. And we knew what was coming, obviously. And we didn't know how large the economic impact would be, but we knew it was coming. So fortunately, we had a lot of food orders in the queue. And so those orders have been arriving at the warehouse, and we're turning this food over so quickly, it's literally out the door almost the next day to pantries or a mobile pantry. But just the sheer volume, if you think of that much food, 4.4 million pounds in 1 month, and we're distributing all that food. I mean, that need, the need is that great. So that's kind of what has fueled all of that, is the immediate, you know, they didn't have money to tide them over. We're living tight financially anyway. And then you throw in, we're missing paychecks. Two parents working in the household, and they both lose their jobs. That's tough.
Yeah. Talking to Kathy Pope, she is director of the Mid-South Food Bank. If you go to 929ESPN.com, you'll see a link to contribute to the food bank. Desperately needed. Kids. How many kids in this community are hungry?
One in five.
One in five.
So that means, yes, they don't have continuous, consistent access to nutritious food to live a healthy life. You know, they're either having food that is not, does not have high nutritional content, or, and we know this, teachers will tell you this, they've got kids that come to school hungry Monday because they haven't eaten on the weekend. So we really do a good job, I think, too, of helping feed kids after school and during the summer. Our community is feeding our children, but the need is so great right now. We are actually supplementing those school children and families with mobile pantries at the child feeding sites that YMCA is doing. So we've all had to just try to figure out, how can we work together? How can we collaborate to make sure that we're feeding those who need them, who need food right now? So it's really been a sweet picture, I think, of our community coming together.
People will say, well, we've got food stamps. Why do we need this? Don't people who are hungry, can't they get food stamps? How does that work?
Well, there's a threshold. If you make just a little above whatever that threshold is, then you don't qualify for food stamps. You may be a working family, but if your income is not high enough to pay all of the other bills that you have, and we know that, that rent and housing, we all know that that's an issue for people who are living in poverty or just above the poverty level. So there are a lot of people that are cut out of the food stamps that are still going to be struggling financially. And then depending on your household, maybe the food stamps aren't that much for every month. So it kind of depends on your situation. We're thankful that we have the SNAP program, the food stamp program. That is kind of the first line of defense for hunger, but that is simply not enough, and certainly not enough in the situation that we're in right now.
What's it like to see the folks who come in who are, I suspect there's a psychological hurdle the first time you ask for food. Like, you're like, oh, I can't. But it must be heartbreaking in some ways, but heartwarming in other ways, to see people get food that they need to live.
Yes, it is really heartbreaking. And one thing that we've experienced is, we will do a mobile pantry, and we've advertised it and put it on our website so people know where they can come. But people will line up at 5 o'clock in the morning for a 10 o'clock distribution. And we can only serve 500 families, and if 800 show up, it's heartbreaking. It's been very difficult. That's why we keep adding mobile pantries to our schedule. We'll do 12 on a Saturday, which is crazy. But, you know, the drivers and the warehouse workers, I mean, they're all working so, so hard to make sure that we can pull this off. But we obviously will direct families to another mobile distribution. But, yeah, that part is heartbreaking, but the heartwarming, we've got volunteers that serve there, and they're almost in tears with how grateful and thankful these families are for this great food that they're able to get to serve.
And if people do give, again, 929ESPN.com, you'll find the link to give. They'll be able to serve more families and have more of these and have more folks be able to eat, which is just astounding that we have people who can't eat. There's no end in sight. There's no end in sight for this. I mean, what do you typically, what's in a bag, by the way, when you give, if you have a mobile food bank this Saturday and someone waits in line and whatever, what do you end up giving them?
Well, and it depends on the day because it depends on what has arrived in the warehouse. But again, we're ordering food like crazy, just constantly trying to find food orders. We're getting it delivered here by the truckload. So that's a 53-foot tractor trailer. It's going to be some form of frozen meat, some sort of protein, frozen meat. It's going to be fresh produce. Like I said, we've really ramped up the fresh produce that we're ordering and getting in the warehouse. So about 40% will be fresh produce. There'll be some bread, pasta, rice, you know, something like that. It is absolutely something you can make a meal from. Maybe tuna fish. It may be pasta and pasta sauce. But you're going to get about 50 pounds of food, and we're doing all of the safety protocols. Everybody's got masks and gloves. The client stays in the car, and we put the food in the trunk or the back seat, and it runs really pretty smoothly.
Talking to Kathy Pope. She is the director of the Mid-South Food Bank. 929ESPN.com to give. We thank you for all your work and
thank you. And
everything you're doing for this community. And I do hope that we can help things just a little bit. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that is Kathy Pope. Again, go to 929ESPN.com. It's, you know, all of us have been approached by someone outside a gas station and someone say, well, I'll buy you something to eat, right? And someone asks for money and buy yourself something to eat. And some people say, well, I shouldn't give them that money because they're just going to use it for alcohol or whatever else, right? Well, first of all, in that situation with me, I'm always torn. Like, is it up to me? That person needs the money more than I do. But here's the larger point. If you give now, you know it is buying families something to eat. Families who need something to eat to such an extent that for a 10 o'clock opening of a food truck, they are there at 5 in the morning waiting for Black Friday to get the best deal on a big screen TV. They're waiting 5 hours in advance to get food for their family, for their kids, so kids don't go hungry. So once again, it is 929ESPN.com. All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show, joined again by Dr. John McCullers, of course, pediatrician in chief at Le Bonheur Children's Hospital, associate dean of UT College of Medicine, an expert on influenza and pandemics, who is helping to advise and shape the policy here in Memphis and Shelby County. He has been busy, and we are grateful for his work. He joins us again. John, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great today, Jeff, and thanks for letting me back on the show after last one.
Well, no, it was fabulous. So I got a tip, by the way, that even in the midst of this pandemic, you make a cup of coffee for your wife every morning. Is this true?
Well, let's not say every morning, or I'll get in trouble. But on select mornings when the timing is
right, okay.
I do make a little coffee.
All right. So anyway, where are we, John? As not so much as a nation, but as a county, where are we right now?
Well, as you know, we entered this phase one of back to business on Monday. That was after watching trends for about 4 weeks and beginning to feel pretty comfortable about the trend of community transmission and our capacity in our hospitals, in our ability to test broadly across the county, and in our capacity to do the public health side of things, which is that contact tracing and isolation that requires a little bit of work by the health department. So we felt last week that we were in a fairly good space where we could start to try to open up some businesses, a small opening, a phased opening, and see if our continued social distancing would continue to keep transmission down to a manageable level with some more things open. By all reports, it's gone well the first few days, and that we haven't, you know, we've seen people taking appropriate precautions. And we think if everyone is taking appropriate precautions, as they've been doing the last few weeks, that this isn't really going to impact our overall caseload or transmission.
There is, there were some who might have had the impression, because obviously people are eager to open up, and we saw on the part of some county mayors, but just generally there is pressure to open up, which is totally understandable. I think some had this idea that maybe that y'all were pressured into, and when I talked to you Sunday off the air, I really got the sense that, I mean, you really, this is, you're comfortable with this in terms of where we are right now. Yes.
Yeah, you know, I think there's two sides to that, in that there are a lot of people who are eager to open because we haven't been impacted like a city like New York City or New Orleans has, and so we haven't seen all the bad things that go on. And I also think there's a group that says, hey, we need to be as careful as possible and as slow as possible, and I get that as well, but there's a balance in there, and I think the mayor's felt that balance. And when they're talking to medical experts like me and a number of others, and we're saying, you know, it's at a good place right now. It's not going to be that big an impact, we don't think, on transmission if you open up some of these non-essential businesses in a phased way, that there was a general sense of comfort, even though we're still not sure how it's going to come out, right? We're going to have to follow the data for the next few weeks, see how it goes.
Is it not inevitable that the numbers go up? I mean, if so, we're looking at the incubation period up to 14 days, right? Isn't it inevitable that in 2 weeks we look up and the numbers are, when the, people are out and about more, there's more opportunity for transmission. Presumably there will be more transmission. Yes?
Well, I guess it depends on how much virus you think is out there, right? We're seeing, you know, 60, 70, 80 cases a day on average the last few weeks. And if those are the only cases that are out there, and those are in little clusters, mainly work clusters or familial clusters, then maybe for most of us, there isn't all that much risk going out and doing a little bit more. If you believe there's really 10 times as much virus and it's equally distributed across the community as opposed to being in these clusters where we're seeing the actual cases, then maybe there we are going to see the numbers go up. You know, I've opined for a couple of weeks that, yeah, I expect to see the numbers go up and then maybe settle into a new normal or maybe come back down to this level. But we might not. You know, you look at other countries that have done this successfully with really the major public health efforts and all the testing. And, you know, they'll see some little variations from time to time, but they kind of have settled into a slow burn of cases every day that they can manage. And they have all the businesses open and schools open. I mean, South Korea never even closed businesses and schools, and they've done fine with it. So maybe we will too. Maybe we'll see more cases and we'll see how many we can manage, right?
So are you of the opinion that there is not a lot of, that the virus is largely in clusters, or in terms of those two scenarios that you just described, or are you open to either, depending on what the data will show you in 2 weeks? How much is out there?
Yeah. You know, I'm open to either. I think what we saw is the first few weeks in Memphis, we were really seeing travel associated. So it was people coming back from Mardi Gras. It was people coming back from New York City or other areas that had been hit, and they were spreading it in clusters. And then we were not testing enough to really have a good sense of, was it more widespread than that at this point. The last 3 or 4 weeks, it's all been local transmission, and most of it has been in these clusters, either familial clusters, work clusters, or the biggest ones have been in the jails and in the nursing homes, so closed systems where you get this kind of easy, rapid spread of virus because there's, you know, the social distancing maybe isn't happening the way it should. Is there a lot of it that's just out there that's disconnected from these clusters? I'm not certain. But we'll see what the data shows us.
Right. There are some who theorize. It's funny. We are all experts now, John. There, me included, particularly. There are some out there who theorize, well, there's a whole lot more out there, and there's much more immunity out there than we think and whatever else. Is that a scenario that's possible or not? I mean, I hear people throw that at me. Oh, you realize it's been out there a lot more and it's whatever else, and probably a lot of us have had it and built up. Where are you on this idea?
Yeah, so I'm of the opinion that there's probably 4 to 5 times as many cases as we're seeing, right? So we're looking at, say, 75 a day. So then you're talking maybe there's 300 a day in a population of 1.4 million in the metro Memphis area. So you know, 4 to 5 times as many sounds like a lot, but when you have this few cases over that broad a population and it's clustering in points, then maybe that's not that, you know, that widespread.
Talking to John McCullers, he is an expert on influenza and pandemics, of course, pediatrician in chief at Lebanon Children's Hospital. Is the end game here to manage this? Is that it? And is there inevitably a level of deaths in the country? Maybe it's 2,000 a day that we are just going to accept as the cost of doing business. You see some countries, I gather New Zealand has largely stamped it out. What should be the end game here for Shelby County or for the country?
So I think everybody can ask the question, could we have stopped it before it spread if we'd really locked down New York City or I don't know if you could knock down a place like New York City, but
right.
you can come up with those arguments, but the truth is it's everywhere right now. And so those arguments don't really matter anymore.
Right.
I think the end game for the next 18 to 24 months is managing it and having some low level number of cases, probably because we can't detect those extra asymptomatic cases that are the 4 to 5 fold that we don't know about, I just talked about. And so it really is going to be living, you know, as a society with social distancing, getting it to a manageable level, and just, you know, kind of managing that low level of cases and going about our business while we wait for a vaccine or a really effective treatment. And I think that's 18 to 24 months, and, you know, we're going to continue to learn and adapt. I think one of the changes in focus we might see, and I'll say this is the first time I've said this publicly, so you get it first.
Breaking news. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Breaking yeah. news. Is I think as we get into, say, the school year or into the fall and we see a second wave, I think the next phase of this is not going to be to shut everything down across society, but it's going to be a more targeted shutdown. And it's going to be, let's really increase our efforts around the high risk. So let's make extra efforts to protect the elderly or over 60, if you want to call it elderly. You know, protect those over 60, protect those with chronic health conditions and immunocompromised, and not do so much for the younger, healthier people who are, for the most part, the drivers of the economy. I think we're going to come to a little bit different approach than just a blanket shutdown. I think the blanket shutdown was necessary when we started to see disease spread and when we did not have the testing and the case management and contact tracing in place. So we had to kind of apply a blanket shutdown. Now I think it becomes more targeted because we do have the ability to test and to trace and to isolate and to do those kind of things. So I think it'll look different, but I do think we're going to have to kind of go through some phases where we, you know, clamp down a little bit more.
Okay, I'm fascinated about how that pertains to schools and universities, which I'm going to ask you about in 2 seconds. But before I get to that, in 2 weeks when the data comes back and you're thinking about moving through to phase two or not, I know you all haven't said, is there a spike that would be to such a level that it's alarming that you would have to ratchet back up the regulations? But can you imagine that scenario where you would have to? Do you internally have a number? Well, we're willing to put up with this, but not this.
Well, so there's two things. One is we do have some defined metrics that are on the dashboard that's up on the public website that we're looking at. And those are capacity of the hospitals. There's the ability to test. Everybody needs to be tested in a broad sense across the community. And that's the ability to handle the public health contact tracing and quarantine and isolation. And if we got to a point where we had no capacity in the hospitals or they couldn't keep up with the public health tracing, and early in the pandemic, we couldn't keep up with
right.
it. So if we got back to that, yeah, that's when we would say, okay, this triggers it and we have to go backwards. Now, again, that comes with, there's a whole lot of other data points we're looking at, a lot of other information that creates a little bit more of a gestalt that you're going to talk through, and that's, are people really social distancing and we have some ways to look at that? are, you know, what else is going on? Are people obeying the mask use? Are we seeing, you know, generally more, is it more in clusters or is it kind of all over the place? You know, are we having, is the increased demand in the hospitals due to COVID or due to something unrelated? So one of my worries is we get into the flu season and the hospital's full because of flu. And then we can't deal with the COVID patients and we have to do a shutdown because of that. And it's not purely the COVID that's the problem. So those are the kind of, you know, extra things that we're going to be thinking about.
Okay. In terms of school, universities, et cetera, a friend of mine said yesterday that a university is essentially a cruise ship on land, which is kind of true. But I think this idea, like in Arizona, I gather, the University of Arizona, they're already setting aside quarantine dorms, and with the idea that they wouldn't shut it down. That, and we've talked about this in terms of leagues, that there's, if you're going to proceed, you can't shut things down when one Utah Jazz player gets it or one freshman gets it at a university. Is that sort of what you're imagining? Is that these places, and obviously I think probably schools are the most important thing to open up next fall, that people, that they might open, or you would suggest go ahead and open and just not shut everything down? If there is, unless there's an outbreak like we see at 201 Poplar or some of these meatpacking plants.
Yeah, so I think you're a little prescient in asking this, Jeff, and that the president of UT has put me in charge of a statewide task force to look at reopening all the campuses. And so we've been really wrestling with these questions the last few weeks. And the president announced yesterday that we're opening in the fall. Now, he could always take that back if, you know, the pandemic accelerated and it became unsafe. But he did make that announcement yesterday, so we can go ahead and start enrollment and start hiring all the adjunct professors and all the things you have to do for a school year. But you're right. There's a lot of issues inherent in that. And, you know, the biggest one for me is kind of the philosophical question of what's the value of the college experience outside of the classroom and outside of the learning you get. And we know that if we send all these college students, the undergrads, back to a campus, you know, 30,000 kids that are going to come into a town and be put into this fishbowl, that we are going to see disease. They're going to pass this virus back and forth between each other. We're probably going to see severe disease and maybe deaths in these kids. I mean, if you look at just the raw statistics, you'd expect a major land-grant university like UT to, you know, have one or two or three deaths during the year from COVID if we get infections going through that population, and I expect we will. So the kind of, you know, decision of do we send them back to class knowing that's going to happen with all the, you know, mitigation factors and the protections we can put in place? Is there a value to the education and the educational experience that makes that risk worthwhile? Most of the kids think it is. We're still well enrolled and people want to come to campus and want to do this. But for the people, you know, the administrators, the president who's making these decisions, that's a tough thing to do. In terms of what are we doing to prepare, you know, there's all sorts of models being looked at as how do you do hybrid classes with some face-to-face and some that are online, and so you can do social distancing in the classroom. How do you protect faculty and staff who might be high risk from the students? How do you protect the students from themselves? We are going to have quarantine dorms on our campuses where if kids are sick, we can move them out of the dorm and into another living space for that period of time while they're recovering. So that is one of the things we're planning to do, along with a whole host of other things. But it's an incredibly complex issue and one that I struggle with. Locally, we're going to have kids go back to K-12, and I can tell you that's my biggest worry about when we're going to see more community transmission. And that may be one of the triggers for us to have to pull back and you know, impose some other, you know, kind of protections. So, but we'll see.
And it's not so much in that circumstance the kids, although, as you point out, with that many kids, there will be kids who get seriously ill, but also the families, because they come to school every day, they go home every day, they come to school every day, they go home every day. Like, that's it, isn't it? I mean, that's the prescription for transmission.
Yeah, the biggest problem is that it's the staff, the teachers working there, and it's the kids bringing it back to family, to grandma, right? Who the kids are going to be fine for the most part. This doesn't cause much illness at if any. I mean, we've seen, I think, 10 kids test positive at Le Bonheur throughout the entire thing, and none of them were particularly sick. So I'm not too worried about them, but you can't make fourth graders social distance. It's just not going to work. They're going to be, you know, if there's a virus out there, they're going to pass it between each other. And then it has the ability to come back into the household and maybe infect grandma, and grandma dies from it. That's the big worry. But the other side of that is we can't have a functioning economy if we take kids out of school for 2 years. It's just, you know, it's driving everybody crazy now. You can't imagine doing this for two more years, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. In terms of that, you mentioned vaccine. So every once in a while we hear, you know, they're doing trials on real people, or we hear about the new treatment that the Gilead, whatever that new treatment was, et cetera. When you were on with us last, you said time frame for a vaccine, certainly for wide distribution of a vaccine, 18 to 24 months. And you said that again earlier in this interview. Nothing that you've learned about the progress of any particular vaccine or cluster of a group of vaccines has caused you to change your mind and think that might happen earlier, like by next spring, for example, so we can have a spring football season?
Nothing has caused me to change my mind about the timeline. I think there's a lot of smart people out there working on this, and maybe we get lucky. But then you brought up the issue, which is even if we do get a vaccine candidate in 6 months or so, what does it take to manufacture and distribute that? And even if we just pretend that we're isolated from the rest of the world, you know, 330 million doses, we can't make that many doses right now. It's not possible to make that many doses of a vaccine. So you're talking about ramping up manufacturing capacity, making all those doses, distributing them, you know, and then administering them. And you know, you can start, we are making plans for that right now, actually. So there's plans at the state level and the local level for who's going to do the vaccination. But it's going to take a long time, and we're not going to be first in line. I'm telling you, you know, it's going to be senators first, and then probably healthcare workers and frontline responders before we get down to the school kids and healthy people. So I can't see it coming quickly.
Okay, I'm not going to keep you too much longer. When criticism has been merited, you have criticized, for example, the fact that we depleted our store of equipment as a nation and everything else, and have not, and so you are not shy about criticizing things when things have gone wrong in the past. But I get the sense, honestly, as I watch these briefings locally, I get the sense that we're in good hands, and that there was certainly a learning curve and a ramping up period. How confident are you, sort of, with what we are doing now as a municipality and a county? And then, if you even nationally, are we where we're supposed to be? Are there things that cause you to tear your hair out that say we should be doing this and we're not? Where are you on that right now?
Yeah, I'll say locally, Jeff, I felt very comfortable and reassured by the responses of the local mayors. They have really wanted to understand the medical and the scientific viewpoint, and they've over and over said, and they've followed this, that we want to do what the doctors tell us to do. Now, you know, there has been some compromise in that, and that's been interesting to watch that political pressure, and that all the mayors had agreed, for instance, that this issue of hair salons was going to be in phase two because that's a personal contact business, right, and it's a little higher risk and so on. And we had everybody in line. Everybody had agreed to that. And the governor had said phase two. And when the governor flipped last week in the middle of the week, unexpectedly, well, you know, there was a discussion between the mayor, some of whom we wanted to follow the state, and others said, well, we're just going to stay the course and do what the doctors did. And we had to come to a compromise, which was move that into phase one in order to have complete consensus. And we thought complete consensus across the county was a more important thing than quibbling over, you know, something that probably is minor in the bigger picture, which is, do the salons come online 2 or 3 weeks earlier, right? So, you know, so I do think that they're doing a good job. They are trying to follow the medical advice. There is some politics injected into it, as you'd expect. But
you did just to interrupt, you did have the and you did. I just want to you did then come up with this 11-point plan. Like, if you're going to do this, let's do it responsibly. It seemed to be the compromise. Is that right?
Absolutely. Now, you know, we had those plans ready beforehand, but it was just going to be a couple weeks later.
I got you.
So, but yeah, now the federal government's been an absolute disaster from the beginning of this, and it's not just the president; it's been Congress. The CDC flat out lied to us about masks. I wrote about this in March on our UT website and said that the information you're getting from the CDC is inaccurate. There is a benefit of masks. The Surgeon General tweeting out, "Don't wear a mask." They're not. He's lying to us, and I'm certain it was at the directive of the federal government, because I know the scientists at the CDC. They know that masks could help in this. So, yeah, I'm very critical of our federal response to this. They continue to not do the things they need to do to support the state. So I think our state has been reasonable. If I were going to be critical of Governor Lee, it would be around the overriding local right. municipalities on the churches issue. And you've heard me talk about that before.
Insane to worship together right now in large numbers would be crazy.
That's exactly right. We have to be able to practice the social distancing, which is what's going to get us through this. And to the extent that places of worship can adapt and do that, I'm all for it. But for the governor to say, no one's going to be allowed to regulate churches, they can do anything they want to, is reckless. And so that's one area I would criticize the state government. For the rest of the part, the state government's done okay. But I've really been pleased by our local government. They are doing a good job.
Last question. Where are we on sports, John? We going to watch some basketball soon? You like the bubble? Where last time you I think your point was, it's sort of like you said about, in the end, if you're willing to accept the fact that some people will get it, you can play without fans. Is that the idea? Well, what's your sense on sports right now?
Yeah, you know, when we talked last time, I said I predicted we're going to have some of these kind of hybrid models come out where it's not a full season, but it's going to be some weird stuff. The NFL is talking about shortened season or half the season here and half in the spring. I proposed talking to after. So your radio show has good pull in that after that radio show went on, HBO's Real Sports called me and said, we heard you on the Jeff Calkins show and want to talk to you about this sports stuff. And I said, why doesn't the NFL just have one season over 2 years and just get in a block of games every time the country's at a lull? And so they're now talking about that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I think we're going to see professional sports without spectators in some hybrid, either shortened or intermittent fashion to try to get through seasons. It's going to be odd, but I do think we're going to get something coming back to us soon.
Does your position on reopening University of Tennessee and task force involve Tennessee football as well?
So it's an interesting question. I mean, we're saying you're not going to have spectators in Neyland Stadium this year. I mean, it's just, that's not going to happen. Whether people want to think it is or not, it's not going to happen. So I'll tell you that. The question is then, do we still play football without spectators? And interestingly, and I'm being told that that's going to be a conference decision, and that the university presidents, who are going to have influence over the conference decision, obviously, are going to abide by what the conference decides. So UT is waiting to see what the SEC says about is there going to be football or not. And so at that level, it'll be really interesting if some conferences say they're not going to have football, and maybe the SEC does and just plays each other, right, or something. It's the landscape's pretty fascinating out there right now.
John, really fantastic. I appreciate what you're doing on behalf of the community, and I appreciate your willingness to come on and talk to us here on 92.9. Thanks very much, and keep up the wonderful work.
You're very welcome, Jeff. You keep up the good work, too, keeping us informed.
Thanks, John. Okay.
Okay, bye.
That is John McCullers with a whole lot of remarkable stuff.
Don't miss the Jeff Calkins Show tomorrow at 9 a.m. on 92.9 FM ESPN.